Good morning, diners and travelers. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig. Good morning, Rabbit.
Good morning. How are you this morning?
You know, I've learned what that tree is I've been dying to have.
Oh, what is it?
It's called a weeping cherry tree.
It's a weeping cherry tree, and there was one outside our window in the Hotel Cheval in downtown Paso Robles.
Yes.
And this is right on theme because we're finishing up our visit to Paso Robles this week with a focus on wine.
Strangely,
since it's
a
region
really
famous for its wine. And then at the end of the program, you're going to learn more about wine than possibly you ever wanted to know with Kevin Zarelli of Kevin Zarelli's Complete Wine Course. So it's a program dedicated today to the juice of the grape, but with some very interesting connections. Our first guest, Mr. Haas, is the man in charge of a rather unique winery in Paso Robles called Tablas Creek, with a connection all the way back to France, and the French winemaking going back several centuries. And then he also speaks about a group he's involved in called the Rhone Rangers.
I love it.
That's kind of a self-explanatory session too. So over to Justin Haas of Tablas Creek and the Rhone Rangers. One of the more interesting wine people on the menu has ever met is Marc Parrin, who's the current leader, although it's only part of the heritage of 500 years of Beaucastel, Chateau Beaucastel in Châteauneuf-du-Pape. And we had the opportunity to have him talk to us about the family philosophy behind the wonderful wines that they make in that treasured part of the world for wine lovers. And one of the things that he mentioned then, which I knew about but didn't know nearly as much as I wanted to about, is an operation that they launched in the United States in Paso Robles, California, called Tablas Creek. Well, here we are in Paso Robles, listeners, as you know, and we caught up with Jason Haas, who runs the Tablas Creek operation. What a wonderful chance meet. Well, not exactly a chance meeting, but welcome to On the Menu. It's such a delight to have you join us, Jason.
Thank you. It's my pleasure to be here.
This must have been just an incredible opportunity for you to get involved in the wine business.
Yeah, it is. The family's been in the wine business for a long time, particularly by American standards. I'm actually fourth generation of my family, which is a long time in the U.S.
But in this region?
No, not in this region. This is new. We got our start back in Manhattan, where my great-great-uncle founded a retail wine shop called M. Lehman. It's since been sold and merged. It's now Sherry Lehman, but it still exists.
Yeah.
That was taken over by my grandfather, who was on the ball enough to get the first retail liquor license granted by the state of New York after the repeal of Prohibition.
That's smart.
And then my dad, when he got out of the Navy after World War II and got out of college, he went to work for his dad. And after a few years of working in the store, his father sent him to France to find a new wine buyer for their store because they did a lot of direct import business. And my dad headed to France in 1954. And he spent a couple of months traveling around and came to the conclusion that he didn't want to find a wine buyer. He wanted to be the wine buyer.
But his career was in wine buying and distribution.
It was. He turned all of those contacts that he made over the next decade into an importing business, which he called Vineyard Brands. And one of the wineries who he's proudest of having introduced into the U.S. market is the Perrin family and Chateau de Beaucastel.
So when they were looking to launch a project in the United States, it was a natural connection for them to make, I guess.
It was, and it actually came out of the trips that they would make around California to promote their French wines, because they would go on trips around the U.S., and California is an important part of these trips because it's such a great wine market. And they found themselves coming back from their California trips talking about how much California reminded them of the Southern Rhone and how surprised they were that the wineries they saw sprouting up in California in the 70s and early 80s were focusing on Burgundy and Bordeaux as their models and not on the Rhone Valley and what they felt was clearly a Mediterranean climate.
Right. So there was nobody really working with Rhone varietals at all at that time, I guess.
Not really. There were a few old Rhone vineyards that had been kind of abandoned in different parts of California, and there were a few people experimenting with Syrah. But really, up until the mid-1980s, there was nobody who was looking to do Rhone blends, nobody who was looking at the Southern Rhone as an inspiration.
So they said, okay, well, if somebody's not going to do it, We'll do it.
Exactly right. They started looking for a spot in 1985. It took them a few years to actually find what they were looking for. But in 1989, they bought a 120-acre former cattle ranch here in the hills west of Paso Robles.
And they looked all over the world for a spot. Then.
They looked all over California. They looked really from Mendocino down through Sonoma and Napa into the Sierra foothills and all down through the central coast from Monterey all the way down to the hills outside of Ventura. And ended up picking the spot here in Paso Robles because it was one of the only places they could find limestone at the surface. It had enough rainfall in the western edges of the Appalachian to farm without having to irrigate. And the climate was favorable, which meant it was hot enough and sunny enough, and there was a long enough growing season to ripen some of the latest ripening grapes in France. But it was moderated by cool breezes and cold nights that kept the earlier ripening Rhone varietals from going flabby.
So they said, okay, so we're going to do this. But we're going to do it right. And that meant it took just a little while.
More than a little while, yeah. One of the challenges was that the quality of the Rhone varietals that were in California at the time wasn't great. And some of the varieties we knew we wanted to work with didn't exist at all in California. If you wanted to plant Cunoise or Grenache Blanc or Picpoul, tough luck. It didn't exist. But more important than that, the really principal varieties for us, the Grenache and the Mourvedre and the Roussanne, they didn't have a very good reputation in California. And when we investigated more closely, it seemed like either clones that were here weren't very good to start with, or they'd been bred for high productivity in the 100 years since they were brought into the United States and they'd degenerated.
So Grenache was a volume wine, which it naturally is anyway, makes lots of grapes, makes lots of grape juice. It's just not very good.
Exactly. It was planted in the Central Valley where they were trying to get 15 to 18 tons an acre off of
Whoa.
It and blend it into jug wines.
It's curious. We had a similar experience talking to the Planeta people in Sicily about Nebbiolo, which is another immensely prolific grape for producing lots of not very good wine. And the current generation told us that, I think it was grandfather,
yeah,
took them aside and said, here's some money. Go. What I want you to do is go make good wine, which they did. And they've been very successful at it, and they've established a wonderful reputation for that. But Tablas Creek is different in a sense because it was a whole new name being introduced.
It was, and we started by getting new vine material, and that, I think, was the most important choice that we made at the beginning. Rather than settle for what was already in California, we took new cuttings of the vines at Bocastel and brought them into the United States through a 3-year USDA quarantine.
How long quarantine is that?
Yeah, it's 3 years, and you're only allowed to bring in 6 cuttings of each varietal. So not only do you wait the 3 years to get them through quarantine, you then have to spend 2 more years propagating the vines that you get through to have enough to start planting.
Right. That's really but you
did,
unreasonable.
You did something rather special in the process of doing that. In addition to creating vines for yourself, you also made those vines available to other people.
We did. We sort of stumbled into the grapevine nursery business, not because it was part of the original plan, but because even while the vines were still in quarantine, we started getting requests from other winemakers, other grape growers saying, hey, when you get some of these out of quarantine, would you sell us some?
So in a way, you were selling to competitors, but that was okay?
We felt like the biggest issue for Rhone varietals in the United States was that the clones weren't very good and that the whole category was suffering because of it.
Okay.
That makes sense.
And we felt that the best thing that we could do for ourselves would be to improve the quality and reputation of the whole category. And we didn't feel like the other people who would be growing Rhone varietals would be competitors. We felt like we're sort of all on a crusade together to broaden what was available in the United States. Rising tides lift all the boats.
Exactly.
It's true.
Now, what is it about these Rhone varietals, both the whites and the reds, that you think that makes them really special?
I think that's sort of a hard question to answer because there's so many different grapes in the family of Rhone varietals that each have their own character. One of the things that I think is terrific about Grenache, which is probably, it's certainly the most commonly planted red Rhone grape in the world, is that it has really nice fruit and it has great acidity, which makes it really friendly with food. Then you have, to complement that, you have Syrah, which is very dark and smoky and structured and quite tannic and ages beautifully. And then you have Mourvedre, which is meaty and earthy and very rich in the mid-palate and very resistant to oxidation. And so when you have these three grapes to work with, depending on where your site is and what the proportions are of which ones you want to use, you can make a really interesting array of different sorts of wines, depending on what your own proclivities are and what you want to express about your place.
Now, there are 15 varieties in, I think it's 15 in Chateauneuf-du-Pape that are allowed. How many of them do you have in the Tablas Creek portfolio?
We have, well, of the Rhone varieties, we have four reds and five whites. Not all of them are allowed in Châteauneuf-du-Pape, though. Viognier and Marsan, that are both common Rhone varieties, are allowed in Côte du Rhône, but are not allowed in Châteauneuf-du-Pape. Okay. So we have seven of the Châteauneuf-du-Pape varieties, and we have two others from Côte du Rhône, and then we dabble in a few other grapes like Tanat and Vermentino, but that's outside the central part of what we do.
Okay, so by now, Tablas Creek has been producing an Esprit de Beaucastel white and red for how many years?
We started, well, our first vintage of Tablas Creek was 1997, and for the first few years, we just made a red wine and a white wine. We called the red wine Rouge and the white wine Blanc. We didn't have a marketing department yet.
I've drunk both of those, and were always a wonderful find on the restaurant menu because they were great wine and a great value.
Yeah, there wasn't very much of them. Then by 2000, we felt like we had enough experience with our vineyard and enough of an idea that we wanted to be able to be more selective for our top wines, that we created the Esprit de Beaucastel, and then the wines that we thought were appropriate for the Esprit de Beaucastel were the lots that were rich and intense and we thought long-lived, and for the lots that we thought were going to be better drunk younger, more open and fruity and friendly, but maybe not with the same seriousness, we created a wine called Côte de Tablas. We did that with a 2000 vintage of the red, and then we did the same thing with the whites in the 2001 vintage.
Now, let's just give people a stake in the ground, because these are not inexpensive wines, but they're great value wines in the price range retail at.
So the Esprit de Beaucastel, the red, retails usually in the mid-40s range. The white is usually in the mid-30s, and then the Côte de Tablas are both usually low 20s.
So they're really hitting a very good price point.
Yeah, I think it's a price that you can get really top-notch wines. I mean, these are not inexpensive wines to make. They're all estate-grown. The vineyard's certified organic. It's from one single vineyard site, and it's all things we do ourselves. Didn't and don't want to price these as luxury products that are supposed to be something that people are afraid to open or are supposed to treat ceremoniously.
But when you compare them to buying from France, they're a huge value proposition.
The great thing about France is that you can find the most expensive wines in the world, and you can find wines that are very inexpensive and still good. So I think there are very good $10 Côte du Rhones, and there are $175 Châteauneuf-du-Papes.
Including Beaucastel.
Beaucastel's not quite that expensive. But they make the homage à Jacques Perrin, which is $500 a bottle.
Now, will you ever make something like that, do you think?
We actually do already. We call it the Panoply, okay. And it's a wine that right now goes out only to our wine club.
Okay.
But it's the same idea. It's a wine heavily based on Mourvèdre that's just a selection barrel by barrel of the most intense lots we have in the cellar.
And that's what characterizes Beaucastel, right? Is a larger percentage of Mourvèdre than...
Mourvèdre was actually the most widely planted grape in the Rhone Valley before phylloxera came through in the late 19th century and wiped out the vineyards. And it turned out to be a very difficult grape to graft. And that's, of course, the solution to phylloxera in the soil is you graft onto North American rootstocks. They couldn't find rootstocks that Mourvèdre would take to until after World War II. And in the 75 years in between, all the vineyards had been replanted with other things. So the fact that it's now basically a Grenache-dominated, Sanceau-dominated, Cunoise-dominated, Carignan-dominated area in the Mediterranean part of France, because those were easy to grow and easy to graft, and they were around in the late 1800s. And one of the real innovations that Jacques Perrin made in the 1950s was he went and found Mourvèdre cuttings that had survived phylloxera, brought them in, grafted them onto the newly available rootstocks, and really set up Beaucastel as the main proponent for Mourvèdre in Châteauneuf-du-Pape.
Okay.
Now brilliant, huh?
Yeah.
It's a really remarkable achievement. When you think how many grapes were lost or nearly lost during phylloxera, I mean, there were 13 or 14 or 15, depending on how you count them, grapes allowed by the Châteauneuf-du-Pape charter. And as far as he could count, there were about four that were really being planted in 1950 in Châteauneuf. And he went and found examples of all of the others and regenerated them into the Beaucastel vineyards.
Now, they did something else very extraordinary during that period of time as well. They went much more organic?
They did. They only used chemicals for about 10 years in the late 50s and early 60s. And in 1964, Jacques Perrin decided he was just suspicious of these chemicals, that it wasn't the way that wines had been made for the last two millennia. And if it hadn't been made that way, there was something wrong with it. And so he went back to farming without any chemicals in 1964 and was blown away with that vintage, with how much more he felt that the wines tasted to him like Beaucastel. They tasted more of the place that he remembered than the wines he'd been making for the 10 years before that. And for him, that was kind of a an aha moment. That was it, and they've been organic ever since.
And you'd follow the same philosophy at Tablas Creek?
We do. We've been farming organically since we started in 1989.
So there's never been a chemical through there at all?
I assume that there were some chemicals in the cattle ranching days, but right. nothing systemic. I mean, you don't need to spray grass a lot if that's... if that's what you're growing.
Unless you're growing lawns, then you spray it a lot, yeah.
So Tablas Creek's portfolio is widely available now?
We're distributed in all 50 states. We are exported to a few countries. We don't make that much wine. Our total production is about 16,000 cases a year, a little more than half of which we sell direct at the winery. So it's not something which you're going to be able to find at every corner store or on the shelves at grocery stores. But if you look for it, you can find it at good restaurants, and you can usually find it at top wine shops.
That's where I found it. I usually get quite excited when I see this, because a lot of casual wine drinkers still don't know the story. So it's always wonderful to see that moment when you selected a wine they never heard of. And you're not being too unfriendly to your budget at the same time. And then when you open it and pour it in the glass, they love it.
That's sort of the great, great dream of every wine drinker.
Oh, well, you're smiling now, and I'm smiling back at you. And one of the things I'm thinking about is of all the wines that put a smile on your face, the Southern Rhones probably do it best.
I think you can taste the sun.
That's
the part of France that is the warmest. It's the part of France that has the most sunshine. It's on the Mediterranean coast. And I think you can taste the warmth of the sun in the wines from there.
And you're getting the same thing in Paso?
In Paso, we have a similar climate. We actually have even a little bit more sun here than they do in the Southern Rhone. We also have colder nights, which ends up being a really nice balance, because you have the brightness of the fruit from the warm days and from the sunshine, and then you have the nice acids to frame that fruit from the cold nights.
Well, it's been wonderful to talk to you about. It's a great story. Listeners, I hope you'll feel like you just discovered some wines to add to the ones you look for as you go and search for wines. What does the future hold?
Well, we have the rest of the Chateau Neuf-du-Pape varieties in quarantine now, so people will have the chance to figure out what grapes like Terre Noire and Bourbalanque and Claret and Picardin are like in California, which I think is really exciting.
So the wine's only going to get more interesting.
We're going to have at least more options in front of us. And I think one of the things that a lot of people don't realize about California is that even in some of the best vineyards, the vines are still young. And, I mean, we're one of the early adopters in Paso Robles, and we started planting our vineyard in 94. And that means that our vines are only now 15 years old. And given that grapevines can live to be 60, 70, 80, 90, and make better and better wines as they get older, I'm really excited to see where we're going to be in another 10 or 20 or 30 years.
Well, we're excited too, and we'll watch as consumers, and maybe one of these years we'll have a chance to catch up to you again and find out whether that came true. I'm sure some have a feeling that it will, because all the thought behind it, all the consideration behind it, all the love of growing grapes and making great wine is here at Tablas Creek. In yourself, just as is with the Perrin family, who are your partners in Chateau Neuf-du-Pape.
And you're happy living here too, huh?
It's a pretty nice place to live. If you've been here the past few days, you can see it. It is a great place to live.
So one last question. How do people find out more about Tablas Creek and where they can buy it?
The easiest way to find out more about Tablas Creek is online. We have more information about all of our wines, about the vineyards, the viticulture, the events that we do around the country each year, and that's at www.tablascreek.com.
And what about distribution? Where can people find it? Do you do that, or do you just
rely on people
to see their local winemaker?
We have links to our distributors in each state. It's actually almost impossible to keep an account list. So what we encourage people to do is to email us if they have questions, or to talk to their distributors in the state that they're looking in.
And there's an email address as well?
Probably the best email to use is just our general delivery email, which is info@tablascreek.com.
I don't know whether it was a play on words, but I'm guessing it was, that when a group of American makers and interested parties with Rhone wines came along, they decided they would form a group called the Rhone Ranger. Were you behind that name?
I was not behind that name, though the Wine Spectator deserves full credit for that. They had a cover story on Randall Graham of Bonnie Doone back in the mid-1980s, and had him dress up in full Western gear, complete with a badge and pistol, and called him the Rhone Ranger. And the moniker stuck. And it started getting applied more broadly to other producers of American producers of Rhone varietals, and eventually was incorporated as a nonprofit dedicated to the education and promotion of these varietals.
So that's the mission.
That's the mission. The mission is to educate the consumer and the trade on the American wines made from the grapes of the Rhone Valley.
So it's a national organization.
It's a national organization based in the Bay Area.
Oh, it's based in the Bay Area.
It's based in the Bay Area, and it includes wineries mostly from California, but also a decent cohort from Washington State, and then a few from Oregon, Idaho, Texas. We have one from Michigan, and we have one from Virginia.
Yeah. And you serve as the?
I'm the president of the board of directors, and we've been members since 1999, so we're one of the longest-standing members of the organization
I would think your mission and their mission would be somewhat similar.
There's a very good reason that we're active members in this organization. It's so central to what we do in trying to educate people about these grapes that we've dedicated our winery to.
Are you trying to educate the consumer, or are you trying to educate the wine industry, or is it both?
Both. The good thing about starting with varieties that hardly anyone knows is that there's lots of education to do, and you can target your efforts pretty broadly and know that they're going to have a useful impact.
Now, do you all meet as winemakers from time to time as well?
We don't do that enough, I think. We tend to meet to do promotional things. So we do three major tastings a year, one in San Francisco that's actually coming up at the end of March. I leave for it tomorrow.
Oh, that's the virtual one? Or, no.
There is going to be a virtual component to it,
the
main tasting
exciting.
Is for a couple of thousand people at the Fort Mason Center in San Francisco.
Isn't that a first that kind of...
Yeah, we realize that even though San Francisco is a real hotbed for wine lovers, there are an awful lot of wine lovers who don't live in San Francisco and don't live close enough to conveniently come to a tasting there. And so we worked out a new partnership with a company called Brixer. And their website is brixr.com, where they rebottle wines without exposing them to oxygen in these 50 milliliter screw cap vials, and then ship them around the country to allow people the chance to get tastes of different wines. And then they integrate this with live online video. So you can interact with the winemakers whose wines those are. You can interact with other people who are tasting the wines at the same time online. And you can have really a virtual wine seminar or virtual wine tasting.
I think that's brilliant. I love it.
Now, do they host that?
Yeah, they host it on there. They have their own platform, their own server that they host this on.
Mm-hmm. We saw those little tasting kits, really very clever.
And they can ship the tasting kits almost everywhere around the country. They can ship up to 42 states, I think. And they have the option of either tuning into a live tasting, so they give you advance warning, like we're doing with our Grenache seminar this weekend up at the Rhone Rangers. People have been able to order these tasting kits of the wines that will be shown in the Grenache seminar for the last 2 weeks, and then can tune in at 1 o'clock on Saturday and taste along with the winemakers. Or these tastings are archived on the website, and somebody can order the tasting kits later taste along and watch the conversation. The only thing you don't get then is you can't interact in the same way, but you can still watch what everybody else is saying and listen and taste with that sort of context.
Somebody was doing that with a website that was promoted through email, and but you had to buy a bottle, I think, of what they were doing. I think this seems like a good idea if it takes off.
I think so. It seems to me the most thought through way of integrating direct shipping and the internet and social media that I've seen yet for wine.
Now, you think the work of the Rhone Rangers is paying off?
I think it's paying off, but I think it's still at the fairly early stages.
Well, you did a presentation with 9 of your members, winemakers, that I thought went very well.
Absolutely. I think the thing about the American wine industry is that there are only really 6 varieties that people generally know much about. I mean, once you get past Cabernet, Chardonnay, Merlot, Pinot Noir, Sauvignon Blanc, and Zinfandel, it's a pretty clean slate. And so one of the things that we try to do as members of the organization is create opportunities for people to get in front of the wines and get in front of the people who make the wines. And the event up in San Francisco includes three different seminars. It includes a 15 winery winemaker dinner, and it includes a trade tasting and a consumer tasting that'll have over 1,000 people.
Now, you mentioned there are other events as well. The San Francisco one is just coming up.
Yep. The other events that we do each year, we do a tasting in Seattle in July and a tasting in Los Angeles in August. And we're going to be debuting a new partnership this year with the Smithsonian Institution around their Sustainable Seafood Conference that happens in June.
See,
that'll happen in Washington, D.C.
Very, very good.
I actually made a note of that to get the information, listeners. So when I find out about that, I'll put a posting on the website so that you can find out more and be a part of that if you'd like to be, because it seems to be two things coming together really nicely to forward the whole, if you like, healthy food and drinking idea. I think it makes me feel good to know that Chateau Neuf-du-Pape is organic, that Talus Creek is organic. It tends to make a lie out of people saying, I really can't be organic in the wine business.
Yeah, I honestly think that if you can't farm grapes organically, then you can't farm anything organically. I mean, grapes are susceptible to many fewer natural pests and parasites and diseases than most other plants. So it's comparatively easy, at least in California, where you don't have really intense weed pressures or mildew pressures to farm organically.
Now, just to be entirely clear, there is a little use of chemicals in the making of wine itself.
Well, no, it's not chemicals. No? It's a mineral.
A mineral, okay.
The most wineries and most wines are made using small amounts of sulfites.
Right. That's what I was referring to.
Which is actually, it's a perfectly legal thing to put on an organic vineyard. And in fact, most vineyards do spray with sulfites. It's just that it has been specifically written into the U.S. organic law that if you use sulfites in the production of food or drink, that food or drink can't be called organic. And this is different than the rules in Europe and in most of the rest of the world, where if you grow your grapes organically, you can call your wine organic wine, whether or not you use sulfites. Whereas in the United States, you can't.
I see. So, but you are truly organic at Tablas Creek.
Yeah, the vineyard is certified organic. We don't make organic wines because we do use sulfites in the winemaking.
Right.
Because that
was a distinction I would.
Yeah, I mean, if you don't use sulfites, it makes wines very unstable. They are prone to oxidation. They're prone to turning to vinegar, and which is why most sulfite-free wines really had better be drunk in the first couple of years.
Right. And because that's something nobody wants.
Nobody wants bad wine.
The last thing you need is an investment in wine, and it will spoil before you get to drink it.
Exactly.
Makes sense to me.
Yeah, I think so.
Now, there's a website for Rhone Rangers, too.
There is. It's rhonerangers.org. And on it, we have information about all of the events that we have. We also have educational bits about all of the different grapes that the Rhone Rangers work with. And then a chance to interact with the wineries who are members. So if you want to use that as a portal into the producers of Grenache in Santa Barbara County, you can do that on the website. Or if you want to do a tour of Syrah producers in Mendocino, it's a great place to start.
Well, it sounds like great work that should continue, and I'm sure you'll do everything you can to make it continue and be successful.
And hopefully bring it to a broader and broader audience.
Thank you so much, Jason.
It's been my pleasure.
You were probably wondering when we were getting around to taking a break.
Now it's done.
Here we are.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig, and we're in Paso Robles in spirit.
Yeah, let's do the usual stuff, though. Please keep in touch with us through our website.
Right, yeah, and check out Peter's new blog.
Yeah, onthemenuradio.wordpress.com, and excuse me for the time being. There's good content there, but there's not a lot of it yet. And I'm still trying to figure out the program to make our website look even more seductively attractive than it otherwise would be.
Right. Now, we're talking wine, as we said at the beginning of the show, And this was an interesting experience. I mean, can you imagine at 8:30 in the morning being confronted with a layout of wine glasses with a frittata or whatever it was?
one of them is a red wine called the Crash. So you can tell you're in for a rather interesting piece of commentary here. But this is a story not just about wine in the modern era in Paso Robles, but a link between a family and the land in Paso Robles,
yes,
going back a very long time, for at least by American standards, going back, I think, a connection that goes back 100 years and five generations. So Cindy Newkirk Steinbeck, or the other way around, I forget which it is, gave us the story of the Steinbeck family, not only historically, but what they're up to today, which is very interesting and exciting.
One of the things you quickly find when you're with Paso Robles winemakers is that every one of them has an intriguing story about how they got into the business, how their property got started. Cindy Newkirk Steinbeck, welcome first of all to On the Menu. And your winemaking in the family goes back well over 100 years.
Yes, this past year we celebrated 125 years in Paso Robles.
But you've changed the game along the way. So if we go back to 1882, you're grandfather or great-grandfather grew grapes on his beef ranch.
Yes, he did.
So
he grew quite a few acres of vineyards. He had 25 varietals of grapevines.
Oh, my goodness.
They made about 2,500 gallons of wine per year for about the first 50 years here in Paso Robles.
So he was making wine, but it wouldn't be recognizable as today's Paso Robles fine wine.
I wouldn't think so, no.
So fast forward to 1982, and your father began again.
Yes, he did. On the property we now reside on, my father started planting for Gary Eberle the first Cabernet Sauvignon and the Chardonnay in our vineyards.
Okay, so you were actually planting specifically for a winemaker.
That is correct.
Who is a good friend of On the Menu, incidentally.
Yeah. Excellent.
And quite a marvelous larger-than-life character who is not in Paso Robles and we are, otherwise we'd be having him on the program again. But your involvement is more recent than that, and special in a different way.
Yes, for 12 years my husband and I have resided in Paso Robles. We live in the home in which I grew up. My family asked me to come home to farm. So for the first 10 years back in Paso, I was on a tractor. I did irrigation. I did anything the boys did. That's what I did. But then I began to realize that my family story was so amazing that it needed a voice, someone to pick up the ball and run with that story.
That meant one thing, I think. It's interesting. You decided to start making wine again, but wine the right way.
That is correct. We started making wine with the 2006 vintage. So we hired a fantastic winemaker, Steve Glossner. We asked him to take fruit from our vineyard, just 1% of the grapes we grow. We asked him to take that fruit and craft it into a beautiful, elegant wine product so that we could tell our story directly to consumers.
The wine has a rather intriguing name.
There is one wine called The Crash.
Oh, yeah, that's
otherwise
a good story.
Otherwise, we have individual varietals, Cabernet Sauvignon, Petite Syrah, Zinfandel, and Viognier. But then our blend is called The Crash.
Explain that, please.
Yes, The Crash, the name The Crash commemorates an airplane crash, a B-26 crashed in our field in 1956.
Wow.
I thought, to cut to the end of that story, some of the people on the plane died, but two of them are still alive.
That is correct.
But they don't fly anymore.
No, they don't fly anymore. So when we named the wine, as I was drinking a glass of The Crash, I looked at the glass of wine and I looked at my vineyard and I said, I wonder if any of these men are still living. So we set out on a journey to find them, and they fortunately live in the same hometown that they grew up in, so we were easily able to find them. One of the gentlemen is 86 years old, lives in Boston. The other is 78 and lives in Utah. So we have found them and gotten in touch with them.
Weren't they thrilled?
They were thrilled, and not just to talk with us, but they were thrilled after 53 years to speak with one another.
Yeah, amazing.
Yeah, because they didn't even know each of them where they were, I guess.
No, they had completely lost track.
But you're constantly inventing, having reinvented your career a couple of times and now become a fine wine producer rather than just a farmer. You took the name Crash and you said, no, I can use that name for something else.
You know, if she's an educator, remember, she's a teacher.
Well, I'm going there. Hold on a second.
Okay.
I mean, I'm trying, without saying Cindy invented crash courses, I'm trying to get there.
Certainly.
Go ahead, Cindy.
So 6 years ago, as I was sitting on a tractor, I said, I am an educator. What have I done? And so I began exploring the concept of agritourism. And I came up with a concept. I explained my ideas to my parents and my husband. So we started a business called the Wineyard at Steinbeck Vineyards. It includes a Jeep ride and an extensive educational presentation. So I kind of did that for about 6 years. But after we opened the tasting room, I said, this needs a revamp. I need to come up with a refresher on this business idea that I had. And I said, well, the crash. We've got a wine called the crash courses. I could offer crash courses. And so I evolved the concept of agritourism just a bit further to give people more options at a bit of a lower price so that they could have a wine education experience, and now I could include wine tasting in that experience.
Well, I mean, you're amazing. You're always thinking ahead. You don't reveal your plans altogether at one full time, but you even have plans to do something different that you just let your father in on. Tell us about that.
We have a barn that was built on the ranch in 1923, and my dream is to create a wine processing plant out of that barn that's an historic barn.
So right now your wines are made somewhere else.
That is correct.
There's a special facility. What's it called?
It's called Paso Robles Wine Services, and they cater specifically to folks like me that are a startup brand that need a facility in which to crush, to process the wine, and then to bottle the wine.
Of course. I mean, you must have a place to do that. If you don't have a place, you don't have a place. So the last thing you built is this wonderful tasting room
that looks
old from the outside and is brand spanking new on the inside.
Yes, thank you.
Tell us about some of the memorabilia you have built in there. It was your grandfather's?
My great-grandfather's blacksmith shop. So when we open up the front doors and walk into the tasting room, essentially you're walking into our history. You pass through our history toward our future, which is our wine program. So when you walk through those double doors, the first thing on the right-hand side is the wine press that was built in 1875. And the family has kept that in perfect condition, and now it sits right there in my tasting room. The next thing you see as you're there are musical instruments on the wall,
yes, right.
A coronet, a flute, and a trombone, all of which were used for our family in their musical careers at some point. We also have the forge that was from the 1920s that was part of the blacksmith shop.
Yeah, that was very attractive, Bostrop.
We also have a beautiful dress that belonged to my great-great-grandmother she wore in the 1900s.
I wondered about that. I guess I missed that one, Jim.
Yeah.
And
okay,
you have an airplane hanging from the ceiling.
Yes,
a small one.
Okay, so next up after that is a real honest-to-goodness winemaking facility.
That is my hope and dream.
Okay.
To build a processing facility where we can house our entire program, which is just 3,000 cases. So quite small yet.
But if you have your own wine facility, you'll be able to make more, right? I mean, is that the plan to grow bigger? Or?
No.
No. Okay.
We intend to keep our wines very, very small production, using only up to about 3% of our vineyards.
Okay. So you're going to go from 1 to 3, but not much bigger than that.
Correct.
Now, we had two wines with breakfast.
Yes, you did.
Always a good thing to have a little wine with breakfast. What were those that we drank, Cindy?
The white wine you enjoyed was a 2007 Viognier. Viognier does very well in Paso Robles. Steve does a fantastic job with keeping the flavors very crisp and bright, but beautifully dry. It's got a lot of complexity, just as we'd hope, coming from our vineyards, this Viognier. And then the red wine you tried was the Crash, which is a blend of 72% Cabernet Sauvignon, 14% Merlot, 7% Viognier, 5% Petit Sirah, and 2% Zinfandel.
It's just a little bit of everything in there.
Yes.
Sort
of a Bordeaux, Rhone, California blend.
There you go.
Yeah, and listeners, if you're going to do this first thing in the morning, couple it with a frittata. Quiche, yeah, I guess it was.
Everybody should have a little red wine blend with their breakfast.
Yes.
I think it's
the reason we asked Steve to craft that wine is so that we could have Steinbeck in a glass. We've been doing family business for six generations. We wanted one wine that says, here we are. And that's what the crash was meant to do.
It's wonderful to have a story of someone who's living a dream. Is that how you'd describe it, Cindy?
I would accept that, yes.
But she also, she represents the spirit of this community, the strong, long family history, commitment, the way this, the whole winemaking thing and the blend itself holds families together, and also looking to the future, innovating, expanding, bringing new elements such as the craft courses. I mean, this is very much the spirit of Paso Robles.
Well, and I believe that I've got a bit of that pioneering spirit in me because of my family. I looked at their past. I said, what allowed them to continue farming? It was innovation. It was the ability to adapt and be flexible. So I said, well, my father was flexible 25 years ago, 28 years ago. How are we going to be flexible? And then we're also, my son and his wife work with us. So he's actually the sixth generation on the ranch.
That's amazing.
And he also is an innovator.
Well, it's a wonderful story. And I guess we probably should give listeners
The website. Because visitors are encouraged.
Yes, sir.
Even though they're not taking crash courses.
Absolutely. Come for wine tasting.
Wonderful wine to be tasted and to be purchased. So what's the website?
The website is www.steinbeckwines.com.
And just a very short distance outside the main town of Paso Robles.
That is correct. So, just 4 miles east of the city limits.
So you have no excuse. And this is a great place to sample what the evolution of Paso Robles has been all about. So, Cindy, we thank you so much for joining us at On the Menu this morning, and we wish you continued success as you live out that dream.
Thank you. It's a
pleasure. Thanks, Cindy. Such a pleasure. Time for another short commercial break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
And here we are again, leading up to a very interesting segment by a master of wine instruction. Is that how you describe it, Rabbit?
I'm not exactly sure what you would call Kevin Israeli, but let's put it this way. I think he told us that all the editions of the complete Windows on the World wine course, or whatever he calls it, has sold more than 3 million copies and is about to be translated into France for sale in France, which he considers a signal achievement, and I can't say I blame him one little bit.
Exactly.
So here's an introduction to the world of fine wine if you're a starter, and even if you're not, there are things you'll learn in this interview, and there are things you'll learn when you get a hold of a copy of the wine course as well. So here's Kevin Israeli.
Kevin Israeli, welcome to On the Menu Radio.
Always a pleasure.
Now, you're a lucky guy. You must have a lucky charm, because you were not at work on September 11th, 2001, at least at 9 o'clock in the morning.
Yes, I do consider myself a very lucky person, mainly because I was able to help those people who lost their husbands, wives, brothers, sisters, children, or whatever it was. So I guess God had different plans for me. But after September 11th, through the wine world and the food world, we were able to raise over $20 million. To take care of all of those, all of their children. All of the children, we lost 72 people on that day, and all of those children's education is paid for.
Well done. That's absolutely magnificent.
That's
just
great.
Just in case you're wondering what's going on, Kevin's place of employment at the time was the restaurant Windows on the World in Two World Trade Center, where he was doing a variety of different things. Kevin, why don't you explain?
You said lucky. Actually, I was 25 years old when I got the job to run the whole wine program at Windows on the World. The restaurant was getting ready to open. It was 1976, and the people who owned the restaurant at the time said to me, we'd like you to create the biggest and the best wine list that New York has ever seen, and don't worry about how much it costs.
How did you get...
A camper?
Well, hold on a second. How did you get picked to do this? You were only 25 years old. If you were a Bordeaux wine, you wouldn't be ready to drink yet.
Actually, I started studying wines when I was 19. I taught my first wine class when I was 20. Before I even got to Windows on the World, I'd been to every major wine region on Earth. By the way, this is with no money, okay? This is called the old Ural Pass Hostel. I live on one loaf of bread and cheese and a little carafe of wine a day. But I became sort of obsessed with wine at a very young age.
Now, why is that?
I started working in a restaurant, and the restaurant actually received the highest rating from the New York Times, which was 4 stars. And the restaurant critic at the time, his name was Craig Claiborne.
Oh, yeah, Craig.
Well, Craig came with Jacques Pepin and Pierre Frenet, who is no longer with us. But
right.
But these three major chefs, and they gave this restaurant a 4-star rating.
What was it?
It's still there. It's called the Dupuis Canal House Tavern. It's just celebrated its 40th year.
Wow.
It's 2 hours outside of New York City. It was the year after Woodstock, which is exactly the area that this is in.
I'll be darned.
So it was like a lot of the sun was shining down, and because we got so busy, I had to become the bartender. I was a waiter. I was trying to get beer money. but they said, we need you to be the bartender because we were too busy. And so I became the bartender, and I was actually, sometimes I think I was a better bartender than I am a wine guy. It was fun. I had 6 years there, and I had to learn liquor, and I had to learn beer, and I had to learn wine. And because I was a history major, I went right to wine, and that did me in.
Well, let's go back to the reason why you joined us on the program today, because if you live in New York, and if you lived in New York for a number of years, you've had access to another adventure as well as being the sommelier at Windows on the World. You taught a wine class there called Kevin Israeli's Wine, Complete Wine Course.
Huh?
And we have a copy of it in front of us, so you're very fortunate. Wherever you live in the world, you can have a copy of this book and you can work through the program. Where did you get the idea to do that?
Well, the biggest problem, and this is now going back 34 years, I was teaching a consumer course, not a trade course. The idea was to get consumers to come to the restaurant and taught the class on Monday nights when we were slow. Hopefully they would stay for dinner, but there was no consumer wine book. There was no easy consumer wine book, let's put it that way. You couldn't read Frank Schoonmaker's Encyclopedia of Wine, or you couldn't read Alexis Lachine's Wines of France. It was just too much for these people. They just wanted to know a little bit. They didn't want to know everything. And so my students kept saying, why don't you write a book? Why don't you write a book? Don't give us this book. So I finally started writing things out as handouts. And then the handouts, after a couple of years, started to look like a book.
Uh-huh.
So sure enough, it became a book.
And it became a book. And actually, the wine class came first. And I also hired a friend of mine to sit in the class. And she would actually write down everything that was being said in the class and all the questions from the students. And that was on a Monday. And by Friday, I had a transcription of was done. So by the end of a year, we really had a book, which really wasn't written, to be honest with you. It was written, but it came from the verbal word.
And what a great thing, because you got the questions that people had, not the questions you might have thought they had.
Exactly. And if anybody does get a copy of the book to help me send my 4 kids through college, they will see that it is a question and answer book. It's user friendly, and I'm happy to say this only because it's been a long ride. As you just said, it's the 25th anniversary of the Windows on the World Complete Wine Course book.
And very handsome, I might add.
They did a great job, but I'll tell you, there's 2 things I want to say. One is Windows on the World, the restaurant, never had a 25th anniversary. It was scheduled for October of 2001.
Jeez.
With the opening of the new wine cellar. We actually lost 5 people, construction workers, who were building that wine cellar. So all this is heavy in my heart, and will always be heavy in my heart, but the book was coming out to be the 25th anniversary, and I said, I'm going to do something special. I re-edit the book every year, but this time, I said, I'm doing a total rewrite, and I went around the world for the last 2 years, and I went to 15 countries, I went to 400 wine regions, I tasted 5,000 wine. I added 6 new chapters to the book that were never there, such as South Africa or New Zealand or Austria, Hungary, Greece, Canada. These are things that weren't part of the book, but I wanted to add them to make it really a complete wine course. course.
Well, hold on just a second, listeners. Now, we heard as Kevin came on just again just now, he's badly in need of a college fund for four children.
Correct.
So please buy several copies of the book, one for all your friends. It's called Kevin Zarelli's Complete Wine Course, and you can buy it on the menu bookshelf, because I put it up on the bookshelf as soon as we got a copy, because it really is a magical thing. The only thing about it, I would say, is that it's not long enough.
Well,
so you're going to have to go around. You're going to have to go around the world again.
But you know, that's the hardest part. I'll be honest with you.
Yeah, what was it we noticed? It was short on Australian wines.
Well, there's no Paso. We just got back from Paso Robles,
right.
And there's no section on that. Kevin's Australia coverage is slender. You're obviously going to have to go back.
Well, here's the deal. I can't.
You can't.
I'll tell you, you can't
afford it.
Right. That's for sure. But look at Chile. It's two pages or something. Argentina is
right.
Two pages. Here's the dilemma. It's a simple guide to wine. It's Wine 101.
Okay.
It gets you ready. And if you take a look, it's very, very important that you read the chapter and you say, okay, I read it. Now I got a little bit of, I got a taste of Australia. But at the end of it there, at the end of the chapter, I say, look it. You want more? Go to Jim Halliday.
Okay, I got you.
So you heard other people, I see.
After each chapter, I recommend, if you will, my competition, and say, if you want to, you can only give people a taste of something. It's like a taste of wine. I don't want to overwhelm them, and that's the problem that I had originally, and I don't want to get into the same problem that the books that I was giving my students were too long, too much.
Uh-huh.
And so, you're...
But now, who's this aimed for? Because some of your questions are fairly basic. When is champagne ready to drink?
Correct.
What's the correct way to open a bottle of champagne? How do I buy good champagne? What is the level of...
Well, he just said that. He said it's designed as an entry-level book, and there wasn't one like that. Right, Kevin?
And let's, I guess, prove the theory here right now. It is a simple guide to wine. It is for a beginner. It is for somebody who's intermediate in wine. But I'll also tell you that I was able to put together my wine list at Windows on the World with that information. So you could say that it's for all groups, but let's say that it is primarily for, you know, somebody, first book of wine. That's fine with me. If that's their first book and they can go on to others, people wanted it. How do I know they wanted something like this? Because it's now the number one selling wine book in the world. It's not a U.S. book anymore. It's the number one selling wine book in the world. It sold over 3 million copies.
Oh, congratulations. That's a great thing.
All the money went to my wife, so I have nothing. I'm destitute. But anyhow, it's booming. It's still booming. And finally, which is really interesting, it's being translated into French.
Woohoo!
Which is, to me, it's in Japanese, it's in Chinese, it's in Korean, it's in Spanish. But, you know, to have a French publicist or publishing company say, we'll publish this book, to me, that's a highlight.
Now, one of the important things about your courses is not just the information that it's contained, but also in each course, you say, now, it's essentially, here's how to taste some wines which are representative of what we just talked about, and you even tell people what wines they should get.
It is a course, and that's new to the book, by the way. That's not something that was there 5 years ago.
Okay, but I think it's a tremendous idea, because otherwise people are going to be guessing. They're going to be all over the place trying to decide which wines to get.
Well, not only what to get, but what order to put them in.
Right.
You can't take a heavy oaked Chardonnay and then go to a Sauvignon Blanc. You guys know that. But does the average person know that? And the answer is that they might not know. So I actually, if you take a look at it, I'm going to repeat what you said because it's so important. After each chapter, and they're not chapters, after each class.
Class, okay.
There are 8 classes. And after each class, after you read it, then I hear the wines that I'm actually serving in my wine school every Monday night. And if you can't find this particular producer, here's another producer to look for. But I also say, if you have 12 wines, here's one wine by itself, and the next two wines are together. And why are they tasted together? To me, I was just following my curriculum. So you can do it at home, is what I'm saying.
Oh, you know, that's exactly the point. You can go off to your wine purveyor or your Pennsylvania Liquor Control Board store, if you happen to be unfortunate enough to live in Pennsylvania, and you can bring home what you need, and you can do it, and, well, you could probably have some food on the side as well, if you wanted.
I do a little thing on wine and food there, of course, as you know, it all depends on the vintage and the wine and how you're doing the food, what kind of sauce you're using, but it's the beginning.
Yeah, well, the thing I like is the section on wine buying strategies, because it gets down to the nitty-gritty of what these people need to know.
I think my job in life, and it's always been my job in life, I've always felt this way, was to find the $10 bottle of wine that tastes like a $20.
Yeah, everybody wants that.
isn't that what we're all looking for, the Holy Grail?
Exactly, yeah.
And the ten, and you know what? That is the sweet spot right now. In the world. Now, I've just traveled around the world, so I'm the best I'll ever be. And I'd say that $10 to $20 range, you could get unbelievable wine. And if you jump up to $25, you're going to get something that tastes like a $75 bottle of wine. And so that's what's in the back of the book, the best wines I've tasted that are under $10, the ones that are between $10 and $20, and the highest I go is $50 retail.
There you go. So
and then, see, here you have one of the most important books for your wine library.
Well, I think it's important. I mean, I am a writer, and I guess I have competition. I know I have competition, but why not? I mean, why not list them? They're good books. The great thing about the wine world is we're competitive, but not that competitive. Take a book like Wine for Dummies by Ed McCarthy and Mary Ewing Mulligan. It's a very good book. Karen McNeil's The Wine Bible. Then, if you want to get those are general books, but then if you want to go into other books, specific books, like I mentioned, James Halliday for Australia, or Matt Kramer for California wines, or goes Michael Broadbent on Bordeaux, whatever is Clive Coates on Burgundy. These are books that I have in my library. Janssen's Robinson's, of course, the Oxford Companion to Wine, is invaluable.
Oh, no, you're absolutely right. I mean, this is just a great starting point to have, and I should remind listeners, by the way, that if you're interested in hearing Kevin's Reilly on a more in-depth basis related to a particular wine, we shared a tasting of, what was the vintage, 2004 Brunello together in New York in January of 2009, and he had some very interesting words to say at that time. So this is a man who's going to be your companion through your study of wine because he has another book along the way. Go ahead, Kevin.
Well, you know, it's pretty much what you just said. I mean, I have a tremendous amount of respect for the authors and writers that I just mentioned, and they're dedicated and passionate. And so I'm putting together a collection of the best wine writing I've ever read. For example, I just mentioned, who does my Burgundy chapter is Clive Coates. Who does my Bordeaux chapter is Michael Broadbent. Janssen's Robinson, talking about how she tastes wine. Robert Parker on what makes a great bottle of wine. And all throughout the world, on Australia, on South Africa, on Italy.
Do you have Randall Graham in there?
Randall's book just came out.
Yeah, we have a copy of it.
It came out just a little bit too late because I was under deadline. But I did go as far. I started with Frank Schoonmaker and his from a book that he wrote in 1941 all the way up to my friend at the wine library, Gary Vanderchuck.
Oh, yeah, Gary.
He's a great friend. His
chapter that I took out was more on business of wine, of the emotional side or the business side of how to do it. So I got it all different. It was probably the most fun I've had doing a book because books, as you probably know, can be a little tedious.
Uh-huh.
Right? You know what I'm talking about. And fact-checking and research-checking. But this one was, wow, I got down and I was able to relive my 35 years of studying wine by going back. It actually pushed me to go back to read some of that stuff.
Well, listen, Kevin, you have when this book comes out, you're invited back on the program and we'll enjoy talking with you again.
Well,
and in the meantime, thank you so much for joining us on the menu today.
I look forward to seeing you guys, and I'll tell you what, I'm going to put some of that 2004 Brunello away.
Okay.
And we can drink it in another 10 years.
Oh, that'd be fun.
A deal?
That's a deal.
Okay. Okay. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Kevin. Bye-bye.
So there you have it, listeners. Goodbye, Paso Robles. Until the next time we go, goodbye, Kevin Zreli. You became our friend. We were on the phone so long with each other, you became our good friend, and we wish you every success, especially with the particularly good cause that you are supporting through the Complete Windows on the World Wine Course, taking care of the children of all the people who were killed during that disaster. And we think of them often. And I'm sure you do too. But listeners, rather than just be morbid about it, let's just say that if you want to get involved in knowing more about wine, Kevin Zreli's Complete Wine Course is certainly an excellent place to start. And if you're looking for an unusual destination in California to go looking for wine, Paso Robles would be a good choice as well. How about that to summarize today's program?
Right. And until next week, bye-bye.